I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. It's almost summer, and for many area kids, that means less homework and more time for the swimming pool. But it also brings concern for those who rely on the health, food, and structural services provided by their schools. Today, we'll find out what area districts are doing to minimize the risks that crop up when students leave the classroom for the summer. Then, Troost is a landmark street in Kansas City, and this weekend, people will gather there to celebrate the storied avenue and the neighborhoods surrounding it. We'll learn the history of the Troost Festival and talk about the corridor's future. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. When school lets out for the summer, just about everybody is happy. Teachers, students, parents, the grind is over for the next 3 months. But there's a downside, especially for kids who aren't so well off financially. Their source of nutritious food is cut off, so is their access to health care. And without teachers around to prod them, students can actually regress academically. They literally can lose ground that they'll have to make up when classes resume again come fall. What can schools do to minimize the bad things about being out of school for months at a time? That's our topic today. With us, Shelby Rebeck is the Shawnee Mission School District's Coordinator for Health Services. Shelby, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Daryl Davis is the Assistant Superintendent for Innovation and Special Projects for the Kansas City School District. Daryl, nice to have you.
Good morning, Steve.
Brent Schondelmeyer is Deputy Director for Community Engagement with LINC. That's the local investment commission that works to improve the lives of kids in the Kansas City area. Brent, good morning to you.
Great to be with you, Steve.
Daryl, a 2015 study published in the Journal of School Health contained all manner of not-so-good news about the impact of long summer vacations on kids. Their eating habits are poor. They watch more TV. For many kids, the amount of exercise they do actually declines. And academically, many students actually regress. So I'm wondering, what's the upside to a long summer vacation?
Well, definitely there is not much upside, especially for students in from low-income environments. And so the summertime can be a bad time for families for the reasons that you mentioned.
You worry about it as an academic. Does it concern you?
It does. We learned some years back that many teachers spent the first month and a half of school reteaching what was learned, what students learned the previous school year.
The first month and a half, you just said.
Yes, yes. And so it has caused us to expand the number of seats for our summer learning so that we can reduce the summer learning loss.
You know, Brent, with stats like this, you wonder why we still do something called summer vacation for kids.
Well, it isn't a summer vacation. In some senses, it takes them away the things that bring pleasure in their life. It takes them away from their friends. It takes them away from access to books. It takes them away from access to digital devices and computers. These things may or may not be available in their own home. And frankly, it really puts extraordinary stress on working parents because their vacation isn't coincide with what that sort of looks like. And it's a very complicated place. I've seen families sit around with these complicated calendars. Well, they can go to grandmother here, and then we can go do here, and then we make this. And there's this effort to really sort of patch this together. So I think we should get past the notion about the hazy, lazy days of summer. That's really a kind of a nostalgic sort of notion. And then if we really want students that are learning and growing and able to do engineering and science, is that their presence in school is really, really paramount. And nobody owns summer, but our community is getting very imaginative and creative about how to be more responsive to what summer sort of looks like. And so we're emerging in this sort of area, but we should stop saying, well, kids need a break. I think the adults need the break, but the kids really benefit from the continuous engagement with adults who care about them and access to things that might not be available in their home or in their neighborhood.
You know, Shelby, you work in healthcare, as I mentioned, and this idea that kids don't get that much more exercise in summer or actually less really surprised me, because when I was a kid, it was just the opposite. What do you make of it, and what needs to be done about it?
Well, obviously, The extra screen time in the summer is a problem. A lot of families worry about safety of their kids. So going outside and playing is really not an option.
Wow.
So as Brent said, you know, having those summer programs at our schools available for these kids, tied in with our summer lunch bunch or something along those lines, is really beneficial.
And you have those programs in the Shawnee Mission District?
Absolutely. This summer we're offering 10 sites of summer lunch bunch from 11:30 to 12:30 every day.
10 sites. And what happens at summer lunch bunch? And can I come?
So you cannot.
As a matter of fact.
Anyone who lives in the community.
The creepy old man can't show up for summer lunch bunch here. Yeah.
Anyone who lives in the community from 1 to 18 years old, they do not have to be a Shawnee Mission School District student.
And what's provided for them at these things?
It's the lunches that we would provide during the school year that meet all of those nutritional guidelines.
Huh. And that's because a lot of kids can't get that at home. Is that go without saying?
Absolutely.
Yeah. And that says something because you're from the Shawnee Mission School District, a sign that the demographics of that district have changed and maybe changed dramatically.
Yes. So currently we probably have around 36% of our students meeting those free and reduced lunch requirements. A little over a third of our population is needing these services.
Daryl, can you match the summer lunch bunch in the Kansas City, Missouri School District?
Yes, we do. We offer a free breakfast and lunch program in the same way that Shawnee Mission does, and it's open to the public. In Kansas City Public Schools, more than 80% of students qualify for free and reduced lunch, and so we don't want the summer time to cause a student not to be able to eat, and so they're able to come in and we'll feed them. As even for those who are not enrolled in summer school, they have that opportunity to come.
How long have you guys been offering a program like this? Because 20 years ago, this wasn't part of the summer program, I don't think.
We've offered it at least 20 years.
Okay. So I'm dating myself here a little bit.
Yes.
How about in Shawnee Mission?
I'm not sure. I would say 15 to 20.
Yeah. Brent, to what extent do schools all over the metro offer some kind of summer programming to stave off the nutritional shortcomings and academic shortcomings we're talking about here?
It varies between school districts. That's really one of the challenges that the community faces. How do you organize this? How do you fund this? How it is that you support it?
Right.
My organization works with 7 different school districts on the Missouri side in the Kansas City area, and many of them offer programs through June, but then the phones start ringing because the parents start saying, well, what do I do in July? And there's another 6 weeks that they're trying to find something to be able to do. In the North Kansas City School District, they've gone to a year-round school, and they've extended the traditional number of days is 180, and they've gone to 210. And these were lower-performing academic schools and lower socioeconomic neighborhoods. And when they extended the number of days, nobody should be surprised, but they catapulted to be really some of their top-performing schools in the district.
Yeah.
The Kansas City Public School Districts, and Dr. Davis can talk about this, has picked a couple schools that they want to go to a year-round school. So rather than talking about it's important as we're in this period of transition about how do we meet children's needs during the summer, the concurrent conversation we need to be having is how do we find ways to extend the school day and the school year, because the evidence, the research, the need really supports it's good for child development, it's good for the family, it's good for everybody involved, and we just need to figure a different way to serve structure. So I fear, Steve, you and I grew up when we were free-range children,
yeah.
And we sort of roamed around our neighborhoods, and
right.
That's really not the case, is that school is the most extraordinary place for these kids, and to see their faces when they're in school, and the thought that they're sitting at home engaged in unproductive activities, and the challenge of, particularly for the Kansas City School District, reaching accreditation, they could be accredited if there wasn't this loss. And we understand this loss as being one summer, but it's cumulative. So it's the loss in this summer when they're the first grader. It's the second grade and it's the third grade.
Well, two things real quick, Daryl. How popular are these summer programs in Kansas City? You know, and to Brent's point, what about year-round school? We've been talking about this and teasing, this idea for decades now, and here we're still not there yet. So first, how popular are these programs?
The summer programs have really grown in popularity over the last 5 years. We have worked really hard to get away from the notion that summer school is only for a student that's behind academically. We know that it's important for all students to continue their engagement in learning activities. In fact, the achievement gap between high-income and low-income students normally can be traced back to unequal access to learning opportunities throughout the summer. And so what we're doing in Kansas City is really leveraging a lot of partnerships through this collective impact, working with Link to provide before and after care. This is one way that we have become better stewards of the children and provided better customer service. And then we've also partnered with other agencies that said, we will help you in this effort to come and increase the number of seats that are available for our students to participate in learning.
Is all of this a precursor to year-round school?
We actually have one school, Banneker Elementary, that we're piloting a year round. And so we've increased the number of school days from around 174 to around 210 for that elementary school for the reasons that Brent mentioned. We see the benefits to keeping students engaged. The plan is to expand this in years to come. As you're well aware, we have the highest ELL population in the state.
And ELL meaning
English language learners. Mm-hmm. And so for a student that is an immigrant that's coming in that really has made progress in English proficiency, to have 3 months off really slows that retention of learning that second language. And so expanding the year-round to different parts of our school system could be very beneficial. And then also, as you're well aware, we have a 40% mobility rate in our school system. And from time to time, as students transition from residence to residence, they may lose some school days within the school year. And so having additional days of school throughout the summer would provide greater access to continued learning so we can reduce those gaps.
So that year-round school, the one pilot program you're offering, what does that calendar look like in the Kansas City, Missouri School District? Are you in class every month of the year then?
It for the most part, it extends the school year by about 30 days. It does have one break in there where teachers can engage in professional development. Students get a slight break, and then they'll come back
like
and
July,
finish.
July, August kind of thing?
Well, they'll still have the maybe six-week break between the end of the school year and returning. But throughout that additional 30 days, there's a small break in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm wondering, Shelby, in the Shawnee Mission District, do you see what's happening in terms of summer programming as a precursor to year-round schools?
You know, I don't know. I mean, I know we're looking at more and more summer programming each year. We have summer enrichment, summer school. We have Jumpstart Kindergarten, extended school year for our special needs kids.
Yeah.
So, you know, I don't know what that may look like in the future, but I know that the need is out there.
We're talking about summer programming at schools throughout the metro for this segment of Up to Date. You know, Brent, I'm wondering, what are the roadblocks to year-round schooling right now? What do you see as holding it back?
Imagination. And then some great work has been done. There's been a focus on this, a part about Turn the Page Kansas City, to try and address the summer slide. I would be remiss, actually, if I didn't mention public libraries. We have an extraordinary set of public libraries in our region on both sides today, and they have become clearer about their role and what summer is. Understand, as a community, we've gone to a lot of expense to air condition our school buildings, and so why not keep them open for the additional period of time so it's not just the 2 weeks or 3 weeks in May? So I think good conversations are going, Steve, but if we really value education and workforce development, there really needs to be a thoughtful response from the business community, because if you want to grow a homegrown workforce, thoughtful approaches about how to better utilize summer, and it can be imaginative learning, it can be experience-based learning, it can be internships. This notion is that kids need a break and they'll be better off if they have the vacation is something that we really need to disabuse the community of, because it just doesn't play out that way for a significant portion of the families in our community.
You know, Daryl, you focused on summer learning loss in your career. Are there certain ages or grades where summer learning loss is more prevalent?
It occurs in all grade levels, but the damage, I'll say, is greater at the early age because, as we know, students, they really focus on learning to read up through the end of third grade. And then after that, they're expected to read to learn. And so if students are behind academically or behind in reading proficiency, it can really impact the later grades. And so it's really important that students have early access to preschool prior to coming to school. And then once they're in kindergarten, to continue to engage in summer learning.
And just to reiterate, the programs you're offering the Kansas City, Missouri district, is there summer learning? Is that a component of what the kids are doing in school when they do show up for breakfast and lunch?
Yes, yes. So it's a full school day, and students focus.
It's a full day. Okay.
It looks like a regular school day in terms of focus on reading and math. This year, we're adding technology components to our elementary schools. And earlier, Brent mentioned the digital divide. I see that technology is increasing in its value in terms of how students learn. And so if a family does not have a computer at the home and they're not enrolled in summer school, they may lose that access to technology, which is so important in 2018.
Is the program in Shawnee Mission similar to what Daryl just described in Kansas City, Missouri?
The
full school day, and there's a learning component attached to it.
So our summer lunch bunch goes from 11:30 to 12:30, but many of our elementary schools are tacking on before and after that for technology and even physical activity around that time.
We have a text here from Allison Overland Park. She writes, as a teacher, I don't think I would have stayed teaching if I did not have the summer break to recuperate from the stress of the school year. Also, teachers need summers to take classes to continue their education. That's a point that you made too, Daryl. Let's go to a phone call here from Linda from Kansas City, Missouri. Linda, you're on Up to Date. Good morning.
Hi.
Hi.
I'm glad you took me right after the statement you just made, because I was thinking about the fact that if we had year-round school, what about bringing in, so the regular teachers have a break, what about bringing in those that are doing their continuing education or the new grads that are coming out and need the experience? It also would give the kids a break from regular teachers. It'd give the teachers a break. Might put a little fun and a little spice into it, and they wouldn't mind going to summer school, going to school all year round. I mean, that way you wouldn't have to call it,
right?
If it's summer school, or even if you decided to go all year round.
Let me get a reaction here from Brent Schondelmeyer about that. What do you think of that?
That's
a neat idea.
That's the notion where imagination comes in. So how you staff it, how you organize it. There's a lot of community-based organizations. I'm thinking of the Boys and Girls Club. I'm thinking of the Boy Scouts and Girl Scouts and other organizations who really specialize and think what summer serve looks like. So this is not to say let's press our teachers harder to work harder to teach more. It's really about how do we sort of address and meet the needs of children and allow the teachers the time off for the professional development.
That's interesting.
Strangely, one of the hardest difficulties is that the custodial staff in the school districts want into the building to do renovations in the period. So there's a lot of complicated negotiations about, well, how do we get in to put the air conditioning in? How do we get in to do this sort of maintenance? And so I have some confidence that given the will and the desire, these things can be worked through.
Shelby, tell us a little bit about the healthcare clinic at Merriam Park Elementary School. What is that about?
Well, this year, Merriam Park applied for and received a community schools grant. And as part of the health component of that grant, we entered talks with Health Partnership Clinic to put a health clinic and a behavioral health clinic on site in the elementary school to serve all students in our district.
The whole district?
The whole district. All right,
how many students do you expect will take advantage of a program like that?
Well, we've only been open for 12 weeks, so it's still building. But I hope to serve on the health side about 15 students every Tuesday afternoon. And then on Wednesday mornings, they can see 4 students every Wednesday for behavioral health appointments.
Okay, we're going to have to leave our conversation there. I appreciate all the good comments. Shelby Rebeck is with the Shawnee Mission School District, and she's the coordinator for health services. Daryl Davis, an assistant superintendent for innovation and special projects for the Kansas City School District. Brent Schondelmeyer is deputy director for community engagement with LINC. That's the Local Investment Commission. Thank you all for good conversation. I appreciate
Thanks for
it
having
very
us,
much.
Steve.
Thank you,
bet.
Steve.
Thank you, Steve.
Time for a break. When we come back, we'll talk about a festival coming up this weekend along Troost. I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. And we're back. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we talked about joint replacement, and I may have told a story or two about my own two hip surgeries, but you can also hear from experts in surgery and physical therapy. Just go to kcur.org/up-to-date. Tomorrow on the show, our film critics return to chat about a doc starring a Supreme Court justice turned pop culture icon, that's Ruth Bader Ginsburg, and a film about the Catholic Church's newest leader, and a movie about a woman shunning monogamy. That's tomorrow on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this Saturday, a block of Troost Avenue will shut down for the 14th annual Troost Festival, but with a recent uptick in economic development, many are wondering, what's next for the corridor, and what about the history that's led us to this point? This is something we've talked about before on the show, and we're revisiting it today as we learn more about this festival. Joining us are Renee Nash. She's one of the organizers of Troost Festival. Renee, good morning.
Good morning, Steve.
Dan Edwards is the outgoing president of the Manheim Park Neighborhood Association. Dan, good morning to you.
Hello, hello.
Vicki Notais is the former director of city planning and development for Kansas City, Missouri. Vicki, good morning.
Good morning.
Well, Renee, what exactly is the Troost Festival? I mean, what happens during this event?
Well, Troost Festival is just an excellent celebration of community. Back in 2004, Ray Peterson and Fred Culver attended a series of workshops with sponsored through the Kansas City Consensus.
Right.
And out of that, after all their work, in an effort to bring people together, Ray Peterson said, let's just shut Troost down and have a party. And that was in 2004. The first festival was in 2005. And here we are celebrating the 14th Troost Festival.
Okay. Who's involved in the planning process?
Well, really, it's the community. Mm-hmm. We meet all year long. Our open meetings are on Thursdays at 7 o'clock. And currently, we have them at Central Patrol Police Station. And the community just comes together and plan this festival.
And what happens? What's available to people who want to go to this thing? What goes on?
Well, we have local entertainment. The festival kicks off at 11. So we have local entertainment, and currently we have over 50 vendors and exhibitors signed up to be on the street.
Wow.
And a total of, well, over 30 performers taking the stage throughout the day.
Daniel, tell us about Manheim Park and how long have you lived there, and what do you make of this Troost Festival?
So we have, my wife and I guess we were renters in Manheim. I think in 2014, we got married in 2014, so we rented a house the month before we got married, and then we moved two houses down and bought our own home in Manheim Park about 2 years later, rehabbed a house and purchased that. And I think Troost Fest has just been one of those things. It's been really interesting because the more and more that Troost Fest has gone on, there's been a lot more feedback from people outside of just our direct neighborhood and community that have been a part of the planning process. So that's been a huge thing, just to like know people in random circles outside of our neighborhood.
How important is Troost Fest in terms of bringing people together? What have you noticed?
Yeah, I mean, it's an amazing thing when you can just bring people back to one like central node of our city that brings life back to it. And then I think there's just like an excitement about Troost, and I think that's just one of those things with a newer, like growing generation of people who have seen the boundaries and the barriers between Troost with color, race, segregation, separation, all of that, and they just don't get it. They don't understand why that still exists, and they're trying to figure out what could they do in order to help solve that or be a part of the solution, which is a lot different even just 5 years ago when we really moved to the neighborhood. So
what extent, how is the neighborhood changing? Because we hear a lot about the changing, evolving face of Troost. What are you seeing?
More white people are coming east. Hmm. So that's definitely real.
Surprising to you?
I don't think it's surprising because it's really it's market forces from a real estate development perspective. People are going to go where they can afford to go. And right now, the most affordable places are further and further and further pushing east. Mm-hmm. So the more affordable places used to be Gillam,
yeah.
South Hyde Park. And now that South Hyde Park has reached its peak in its capacity, there are more people that are coming east, and the housing stock is more affordable. The land is more affordable.
And it's a big change you're seeing. You're living
it is a big change.
Right,
I just saw two young white ladies just walking down the street yesterday, and I'm like, that's
you noticed it. It's that big of a change. Yeah.
That's different.
Yeah.
So it's been interesting to see that. And I think that with that, there's also a lot of fear that comes up with that from people who live east and are worried about being displaced and worried about mm-hmm. their culture being displaced or their rents being displaced. Or
Vicki Notai is, again, former director of planning with the city of Kansas City, Missouri. What kind of change are we seeing here right now along Troost? What's your sense?
There's a lot of momentum right now, which is really great to see. I'm a urban planner and consulting now in the private sector, but was at the city when the Troost Fest started. Renee and I were talking about the first one. And there's been a number of planning efforts on the city's efforts to guide redevelopment. There's a lot of reasons why there was a lot of disinvestment along Troost, and Troost has become the symbol of to some people in the city, the symbol to everything east of Troost,
mm-hmm.
Which, of course, puts a lot of pressure on it. But there are a lot of great things happening, one of which is the neighborhoods along both sides have come together to work for a community investment district, to work on economic development. The city has put their efforts in the ATA into the MAX line on Troost, the green zone. So it's a partnership between what the private sector is beginning to see as potential and what the public sector has been trying to seed in terms of investment to get that started again.
It's a big moment, isn't it?
It's really important. It doesn't happen overnight. It's been evolving for years and years, frankly, but it didn't get in this shape overnight either.
Mm-hmm.
Troost technically is a 13-mile-long arterial in Kansas City. Most people remember it and think of it as a commercial arterial.
Right.
The problem with that is that there's not enough demand anymore to have commercial activity, retail activity up and down our very long north-south corridors. Prospect has the same problem. Troost, Cleveland, Warnell, they all have the same problem, part of which was a historic zoning problem that we finally got fixed with the city when we did the last Troost corridor plan, because property owners were under a zoning category where you could build anything you wanted within a half a block on either side without getting any city approval. It's a very loose zoning category. So you start to get pawn shops, you start to get used car lots, you start
right.
to get a lot of property storage properties that are a nuisance and a problem for the neighborhoods that are trying to rebuild. So to push Troost further forward, it's got to be in combination of neighborhood revitalization, which they're all doing a great job at, and reinvestment in the commercial nodes that can operate better when you get the density Dan was talking about.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not sequential. It's a lot of things have to interlock, and it's all related to each other. And then there's kind of a threshold, and it kicks off, and then things really have a lot of momentum. There's a lot of private development going on now, which we haven't seen for years.
And what kind of private development?
There's new, up around Beacon Hill, which has a long history as a neighborhood with the Vine Street area. Hospital Hill's been putting money into that anchor end with the city and the health department's commitment there. Then on the other end in Midtown anyway are both universities who've committed to stay here. Rockhurst is building new facilities and new facilities on Troost.
Mm-hmm.
UMKC is doing the same thing. And then that's the sort of historic urban corridor.
Right.
What has to happen is probably that residential is going to have to fill in between these big nodes of activity, because there isn't enough market to sustain a lot of retail support.
Yeah.
So that and transit, MAC properties, apartments, residential investment, et cetera, is really helping the Midtown part of Troost.
Renee Nash, as you look at Troost, how are you seeing it changing? What do you make of it all? How dramatic of a shift is this?
Well, it's dramatic. I used to work in neighborhoods, so I worked with the neighborhood groups when they were doing the focus plans. And when the neighborhoods were coming together, talking about what they wanted for their neighborhoods. So actually, what we're seeing now is a big shift because you do see things happening, but we just want to make sure that the neighborhoods are not left out. Mm-hmm. So, you know, as I think about it, that's what's constantly on my mind is just that all ships rise together.
Are the neighborhoods being left out, Dan, from your vantage point, again, as the outgoing president of the Manheim Park Neighborhood Association?
I think, and it's not just our neighborhood, but I think overall neighborhoods, one of the things that Vicky just mentioned is even just as far as density in the market doesn't support it. When a grocery store, like a lot of times people want grocery stores, our neighborhoods want grocery stores, and we want dry cleaners, and we want all these different type of amenities where gas stations, and not just any gas station, but a Quick Trip. And so it's like when these stores go to pick their locations, they put a pin in a map, they draw a circle with a half mile radius, they count the number of people, they count the number of disposable income, and then they say, can we do this deal or not? And that's just, that has nothing to do with what neighborhoods want. It's completely up to the companies and the amenities themselves to come into our neighborhoods.
So how are you working through that then?
Well, so I think there has to be more density, but more density causes fear. And so I think that when there's
fear of what?
Fear of the displacement culturally and financially. So if more people come in, that means that there's going to be a better sustained property tax. That means that property taxes could increase. We have some multifamily property owners that are trying to get the highest rents that they possibly can get per square foot. So that means that the second that the neighborhood can support a higher rent, they could raise their rents, and then that will displace people. So people are worried about that as well.
Gentrification you're talking about.
I am talking about cultural and financial gentrification. Mm-hmm. I think, unfortunately, gentrification has been the catch-all term for white people and black people in communities, it seems mm-hmm. like. And it doesn't we haven't really defined what gentrification, the aspects of gentrification that people are most afraid about.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's where every time we're doing any type of work, people are always worried about, well, this is gentrifying the neighborhood, and this is gentrifying the neighborhood. Well, what does that really mean, and what are we specifically talking about? And I think if we got down to the root of that, we could understand where that fear of the displacement of gentrification lies, and we can root out that fear and then focus on, okay, I would love to have neighbors, right?
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to a vacant lot next to my house with trash being dumped. So if I could have like boots or feet or people breathing in a house next door to me, that's so much better to me than having a vacant house next door to me where I'm worried about if somebody's breaking into that house or doing anything like that.
If you're just joining us, we're talking about the 14th annual Troost Festival taking place this weekend, this Saturday in the 3100 block of Troost, I believe it is. You know, Vicky, this is such a difficult balance that the community walks here. For years, you clamor for more investment, more development along Troost, and you get it, and right away, you begin hearing concerns about gentrification, people being pushed out. And as a city planner, as an urban planner, how do you balance all that stuff?
The balance is difficult, and in a way, it's a good sign because that's where Troost is now. So that conversation
finally
is happening, mm-hmm. and people are much more aware of that. The root comes from the opposite that was happening in our history. There's a reason Troost ended up being a racial dividing line, which goes way back to where African Americans were allowed to live, which was between Troost and Prospect and 9th Street and 27th Street.
Right.
And after the Supreme Court decision that basically said you can't discriminate in housing, you know, that allowed people to go out and make a lot of choices. And what happened was that fear, the opposite fear, where redlining and blockbusting immediately came in because of racial fears at the time. And that drove the disinvestment. When we were working down in the Vine Street area, historically, every dollar spent there turned over 8 times in that community because they had department stores, they had cleaners, they had everything you need to sustain yourself. But when the population dispersed to get farther out for, you know, some lawn and a house of their own, et cetera,
yeah,
they kept continuing to spend their money. No substitute money came back in. And so that's what started the disinvestment. Mm-hmm. So people were unwilling to come back and shop or to make up the difference in non-residents were unwilling to do that. And yeah. So that drove all the residential disinvestment that's happened down the entire East Corridor.
Mm-hmm.
And so that fear of racial issues, you know, it goes into education, it goes into future development. And as that is beginning to turn around, partly generationally, I think, and a much stronger move for younger people to want an urban environment. And Kansas City's got a lot of housing choices, but we're losing a lot of affordable housing for luxury housing.
Dan, you're nodding your head as she's saying that. You're seeing the same thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's construction costs are rising. Labor forces, like contractors, are hard to find. So they're busy, so they hike up their prices. And the only deals that make sense are deals where there's higher profit margins. If you're right. going to spend that much time to build a property, you probably want to get as much out of that property that you can.
Sure.
So there hasn't been, and believe me, we've been exploring affordable development options. But we've been finding that there's this really uncomfortable space between or this open gap between traditional real estate, high-end luxury development and CDCs or nonprofit developers. And there's this hole in the middle where CDCs are not really performing as they should be or right. as they used to perform a long time ago to rebuild neighborhoods and communities. For-profit developers can't make enough money in this gap area. So That's the area that
even well, with putting
real every, quick, Vicki, I got to scoot in a second. Go ahead.
Even with putting every incentive the city has available into new development, there's still a gap in financing on the east side.
This festival this weekend, Renee, is going to take place again on Saturday from when to when?
11 o'clock to 8:30. The last act goes on the stage at 8:30.
3100 block of Troost, right?
Right between Linwood and 31st Street.
So all this heavy talk, and we're going to celebrate nonetheless, right? That sounds
right.
like a good time.
Neighbors celebrating neighbors.
That's Renee Nash, one of the organizers of Troost Fest. Dan Edwards, the outgoing president of the Manheim Park Neighborhood Association. Vicki Notai, a former director of city planning and development for Kansas City. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. Have fun this weekend, too, okay?
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on the show, we'll learn about Governor Eric Greitens' upcoming impeachment trial and how this whole thing is actually going to work, assuming it comes to be. Our show is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Claire Verbeck. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.